how you doing, man? This is such an honor for me. Absolutely.
Thank you. We've been trying to connect for a while, so I appreciate your patience.
Am I going to rush? Come on,
man. Up last year. Yeah. It's a new year. It's a new season. Things are kind of opened up, you know, so it's all good.
2020 has been batshit crazy and trying to get over some of that stuff. But let's jump right into it, man. Tell me about the book.
Okay, so Rockstar Hitman. I always keep a copy here since I seem to be talking about it a lot. My first fictional title, and it's actually a fictional autobiography, which was fun to write because I've written two autobiographies, obviously about me, and my story. So as I started to write this story, I didn't start it to be necessarily an autobiography, but it kind of went that way. You know, guy from the Midwest gets this call to go to Hollywood for the big time. That part is somewhat autobiographical for me, actually. But the cast of characters that he falls in with, that's fiction, of course. And then
is it based off of anything, though? Just kind of like a spinoff of some
people. Well, you know, it's funny. Me and so obviously my career, Megadeth and all that, and then Drew Fortier, who I brought in to, you know, help with some beheadings and slashing and killings and, you know, all the fun stuff. He's got a good mind for that. Yeah. He was in Bang Tango for a couple of minutes, as well as he did their documentary. So, you know, he's been in and around it. He's a musician, a great songwriter, actually. And so he's had his turn at bat. So we could, you know, sort of riff off of some, you know, some of the lunatics, you know, type of personalities that we ran into, in Hollywood and elsewhere. So yeah, it wasn't too far of a reach to find crazy people from the circus that we've grown up in, you know? But the trajectory of the story is, our main character Sledge, who, his name is Toby, but he changed it to like a rock star named Sledge. And then, so he, you know, he signs on with this band and of course signs a contract he didn't read. And, you know, in the fine print was, oh yeah, by the way, during the day, you're going to be out doing some hitman work for the agency, you know? So, you know, it brings in some, you know, some Jason Bourne, James Bond, you know, some of the, you know, the good stuff, you know? So, yeah, it was fun to write it though, because, you know, with fiction, you get to go off, you can go off script anytime you want, you know, and just kind of create cool little turns in the story. So it's been a lot of fun to write it. And the way we wrote it, from Sledge's point of view, so again, kind of a biography narrative. We also wrote it with the intention that there will be more. It's kind of a series of books. So that's exciting because we can end the a story. But it's not the end of the bigger story, you know. So the life carries on.
Lord of the Rocks. So what got you into the film thing, man? Have you always had a fascination, or what's?
Well, funny thing is, you know, Drew had brought this film idea called Dwellers. This was, gosh, a year and a half ago at least. He had brought it over to me and my team, and you know, we thought, well, look, let's just put together, like, we got Ellefson Coffee, we've got EMP Label Group, which is essentially Ellefson Music Production. So we're kind of branding the Ellefson name, around these things, the Ellefson Band, so the Ellefson Book Company. So now we have, Ellefson Films and, you know, we thought, look, we should brand this around. It'll help Drew give a bigger look, obviously, if it's, you know, we're kind of couching it in with, you know, with my little industry over here. So to do that, and it's a great story, and we're going to roll it out next week at Mad Monster HorrorCon over in Charlotte, North Carolina. They're Saturday night, February 20th. So if anyone is in the neighborhood or wants to drive or fly or go to Charlotte for a weekend, I did the Mad Monster. They invited me to do it here in Phoenix. I think it was like September. Or I think it was September-ish, and it was great. It was fine. They had it totally dialed with social distancing and kind of a traffic pattern in the convention room and stuff, and it was super cool. Yeah. So I figured, look, I said, listen, I have appeared a lot of these as, you know, a celebrity, And I realize it's, you know, it's nice when you can bring something to the party. So I said, look, if we can bring the film, and so the organizers are premiering it for us. And now the film has gotten, we've submitted it, and it's been accepted in like a dozen really cool film festivals. So we're going to be busy doing that here over the next
rated few, R or NC-17 or?
Well, honestly, I don't think it has a rating yet. And that's actually a good question. I mean, again, a lot of this I'm learning as we go. You know, it's like when you make your first record, you know, then your parents ask you all the questions, like, I have no idea, you know, and then you and your friends, you start hobnobbing and they're like, so, the downloads and how many, da, da, da. You know, they start asking these, and you're like, I don't know. I guess I'll find that out. So, I know in this, yeah, once you get ready to actually release it, you know, for a commercial release, right now we're just doing the presentation, we're premiering it, we're doing the film festivals. And part of the reason you do the festivals is to get a distributor, for it. So, you know, once then it goes to market, then, you know, by then you have to kind of.
As far as the CD, are you using your music from Ellison Band in the movie at all?
I'm not. And, you know, because it's a found footage genre film, it doesn't really have a soundtrack. I was talking to Drew about that. I said, man, we should put some songs in. He goes, the kind of the point of the, you know, think Blair Witch, if you will. So if the point of that is you don't suddenly like have a, you know, a band playing in the background. It's like this found footage, right? But it is funny because Drew and I, along with Vin, who's a singer of Sponge, Dombrowski, and Mike Heller, who plays drums in Raven and Fear Factory, we actually wrote an album and recorded an album, lyrically, mostly a sort of a bed track to the book. So we're just kind of figuring out sort of when and where that kind of comes into it. Like I said, now that we're going to the film festivals and looking for the distribution and doing all those kind of things, you know, to have this record done, you know, kind of makes a cool companion piece to it. And we'll figure out what that's going to look like here in the weeks.
You're obviously the head honcho, man. Are you writing everything or is it more collaboration with
the- No, it's collaborative. I mean, I started the idea of obviously the book, and then brought Drew in to, you know, help me color it. Bloody red mostly is the color he brought in. The Dwellers film, that's all him. He wrote, directed, starred in it. You know, I'm essentially the producer of it. Nice. The record was mostly Drew and Mike actually wrote them, and Vin. You know, I came in and initially just played bass on a song. I was like, these are cool tunes. I like this. This is, you know, kind of Cheap Trick meets, you know, kind of a little Sponge, I guess, in there. You know what I mean? It's kind of more of a 90s radio rock kind of sound to it, you know, which I like. I like to, when I play on other people's stuff, I don't like to just go in and play metal and thrash metal.
I was going to say, man, like Marty Friedman, it's very, very gun metal.
I'll do that with these guys back here. You know, I Megadeth's the best, so I'll do that over there. You know, so when people call me to play in things, I actually enjoy when it's not metal, when it's something, you know, rock. You know, Frank Bello and I did Altitudes and Attitude a couple years ago, and that was, you know, fun for us, a couple of thrasher dudes to, you know, play, you know, music that could, you know, sit somewhere between Foo Fighters and U2 or something, you know. So it's, you know, it's nice when you get these outlets and you can, and, you know, find a home for some other things that we write.
You do any vocal on any of this?
That one I didn't. Vin did all the vocal. I love, man, Sponge. I remember when Sponge came out because Megadeth, we were doing a lot of like, you know, Euthanasia, Cryptic Writings, Risk, you know, those are the records, the Megadeth records we were doing at that time. And I remember Sponge when they were, you know, in the mix, you know, we were kind of competing for spots on the radio charts. And I always loved their sound. But that one, no. The next Ellefson stuff, yeah, that for sure I will be. And
Dave Mustaine doesn't mind that you're doing that shit. I remember I watched like Some Kind of Monster when fucking everybody was all over Jason Newsted because he wanted to do something else. So
here's kind of the thing. So look, for 20 years, you know, obviously we were, you know, locked like a fist, you know, as we built Megadeth, you know, and then in 2002. you know, Dave stepped back from it and it essentially disbanded, and it sort of left all of us in a position where we had to go do other things, you know.
Out of me and everyone I know as well too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was 38 years old, I had a young family, I was certainly had a lot of energy, a lot of creativity, you know, and even financially it's like, look, money goes quick, you know, when you're not earning more of it, you know. So you know, I knew, like, look, I can't just sit back and retire, you know, I got to go do other things. So I got busy with other things, and originally it wasn't music stuff, it was kind of more business things, kind of really just thinking of out of the band box of some other things to do. So I ran artist relations for Peavey for 7 years. Yeah, and that was actually very cool. Then I went to college, I got my degree. Really? Business during that time. So that was a kind of a different season of my life. You know, I've been in a band for 20 years. We obviously did well. So I just took that opportunity, you know, to do other stuff. And then at the same time, band things started coming around me. I had a little group called F5.
Tornado Preppers, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's either that or the keyboard button on your PC, which is so we did that, and I played with Max Cavalera and Soulfly, you know. So, yeah, I got to musically kind of stretch out and do some very different things. And then 2010, when, you know, I came back to Megadeth, and I never saw that season as, like, the end of me and Megadeth. I just saw it as there was just some space, you know. And
I got a few questions on that. I kind of want to touch on the coffee thing. You're like, I'm in a horror flick, we're making an album, and I sell coffee. Like, it's like, all right, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, so Ellison Coffee, excuse me, Ellison Coffee, you know, we started that 4 years ago, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And I mean, I drink coffee every day. So, you know, a lot of these things are about branding and just kind of, you know, bringing your name to a product and these things. And, you know, initially it was just kind of someone else was sort of roasting it. And then we quickly outgrew that process. So then next thing you know, I've got an entire coffee company, and that's been a fun process. You know, I mean, I don't go to Guatemala and pick the beans out of a, you know, off a bush. And I mean, I don't do that much of it, you know, but we, you know, it's our brand. We have a roaster here in town. We have a roaster over in London. We got a roaster down in Brazil. And then, you know, we label it and put it out. So that's what we do.
I just heard like some dumb Alice in Chains parody. Yeah, come to snuff the roaster. All right, man. Since we don't have too much time, I know you got a lot going on right now. I went around. I don't want to bogart you myself, because I mean, I don't usually get starstruck, man. My aunt's Charo, I kind of grew up with this, but like, you really, like, you're the man. Like, you really are. I've been a fan for the longest of times, man. So what I did was I went around. I asked some people questions. If they want to ask you anything, what is it?
Sure.
So I got a few of these here. Don't kill the middleman, but
fire away. Fire away.
Fire away. Fire away. All right. So let me see. Chris Buzea asks, what was your time like at Musicians Institute, and what did you take from it?
My only time at Musicians Institute was to go in to get the form to apply to the school. I never actually went. I ended up starting I started Megadeth instead. I took a look at the school and I thought, play thrash metal with Dave. I think I'm going to do the metal thing. So
here's a funny story, man. You lived off the Sycamore, right?
Mm-hmm.
Man, I used to, it was like 20 years ago. I was in a band called Treason, and I'm a guitarist too, but the other guitarist lived in that building. And I shit you not, man, like every day I would pick him up and we just sit there and just talk. You know, he was playing a Van Halen song and the pot and all this shit. Now I'm like, now I'm talking to you, man. It's bizarre.
You got a bass behind you. You can do that too. And who knows?
Yeah, I know. But
running with the devil starts all kinds of great shit in life.
That's awesome, dude. I mean, that's just such a unique fucking story. All right. So cool. In no particular order, Goat Hill Massacre asks, if you were to start all over again, what steps would you take to become successful in today's market?
Jeez. I mean, I'm kind of already doing that because, you know, even Megadeth, I mean, look, we went through our transitions. You know, we start, you blow up the world, you go. You know, suddenly Seattle music showed up and radio and MTV.
Does that affect you guys at all? Sorry, but like that grungy thing, did it take away?
I mean, I like the music. I have nothing against the music. I'm just talking from an industry, you know, point of view, because you can play music for personal enjoyment. Doesn't mean you're going to make a living at it. And when you're in an industry, it's just like sports. Just because you can throw a football doesn't mean you're going to be an NFL quarterback. You know, you can even be good at college and you may not be an NFL quarterback. So there's always these benchmarks along the way, that, you know, you're constantly tweaking the things that you do, you know, how you play, how you look, your presentation, your stage show, the production of your records. You know, it's not like it all just happens. There's every little thing is part of building, you know, a better machine, if you will, you know. And even though you had success once, you know, like, look, Dystopia did well. We won a Grammy. It was top of the charts. That was what, almost 5 years ago, you know. So we live in a different world today than we did then, you know what I mean? So even if we just rewrote Dystopia, it you know, again, there's new fans, there's, you know, there's new people have been born that have come that are now going to buy the next Megadeth record. And, you know, so there's a lot, you know, and plus, you know, who are you just as a writer and as an artist, and what do you have to say, you know, about things that have happened? So I always say you try to control the things from within, which are, you know, how you play, how you look, you know, how you keep your band together, like those things that you try to control. Then there's things from without you have no say over. I mean, the pandemic is a perfect example. I mean, this, no one saw this coming. I mean, we, you know, bang, everything changed for everybody. And look, if you write songs about the pandemic, they're, you know, period pieces, but they're certainly not going to be timeless songs, you know? So, to write a song about the pandemic, you really have to dig deeper into something that goes beyond just, and then in 2020, you know what I mean? It's like, and it's so obvious when you read it, you go, oh my God, okay, they're writing about the pandemic, you know? And it's as much as it's a story we all share, are we really going to want to read about that forever? It's not like it was a fun time, you know, let's write about the party, you know?
What was it like adapting to, because I mean, people don't buy albums anymore for the most part. So, mm-hmm. What was it like adapting to the new format? I mean, you sell out everywhere you go. You're freaking mega.
Fortunately, you know, Megadeth, Capitol Records built us the very first band website ever back in 1994 when we launched Euthanasia. They built this
first band website.
Yeah, Megadeth Arizona. And they flew out here. We made the record here in Phoenix. We'd moved out here. We built a temporary studio. And I remember they flew out here and we sat down and have the meeting with the top, you know, marketing people. And they were like, I think we want to investigate using this thing called the World Wide Web, you know? And we're like, well, what exactly is it? And they're like, well, we don't really know yet. It's all kind of being developed. The Wild West, you know, there's all these sort of buzzwords that were used about it, but they said it, we definitely feel it's going to be the next technology and we want to launch the record with it. And they built Robin Bechtel, who worked at Capitol, was kind of the chief of, and there's good stuff on the internet that you could look her name up. And she talked very openly about sort of the process of what they were doing inside of Capitol, how it, you know, parlayed over to Megadeth and the launch of the record. So fortunately, you know, that, and then we, some fans registered Megadeth.com. They bought that from them so we could have that as our home. And, you know, we did, this was in the kind of mid to late 90s. And so in acquiring these things, you know, we were moving into the digital age. And then of course, Napster started blowing up and that was a big thing. And
we all know how that turned out.
Yeah, I mean,
I didn't do shit like that.
You know, and it's like, fortunately, that all got worked out as we knew it would. You know, that was just a moment. But look, you know, I buy everything on here. I have a, you know, on my iPhone, I do Apple Music. I don't do Spotify. I make money from Spotify by owning their stock because they sure don't pay us for our music.
There you go.
But, you know, I'm an Apple guy. You know, I love Steve Jobs. He came in and corralled this sort of, you know, insurrection, people use that word, because that's what it was back when, you know, Napster and the stuff was going on. They were just coming in, just stealing everything. It was, you know, plundering and assaulting our industry. And so fortunately, you know, Jobs, he really put it together, you know, with the iTunes store and with his new device, the iPod, you know, and he figured it out, and we get paid from that, and we get paid fairly from that process. So that's why I've been a real advocate, and my loyalties lie to Apple, because they pay us. And you know, and here in America, we've got Sirius Radio, you know, the radio, you know, subscription radio is great. You know, it pays bills. You know, we're getting compensated fairly for the use of our work, you know? So, I mean, that part of it is a business, you know? And it is that we got to take care of that, and we hire people to take care of that for us, so we can sit around and write songs, you know, and do what we do.
I've got a few part question.
Okay.
This one comes from me, actually. So Okay. You can kill the messenger, I guess.
Now you can shoot the messenger here. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, whatever. At any time, did it bother you that Dave, obviously, was making such a fuss about getting kicked out of Metallica, to the point to where it almost seemed like Megadeth came second, and it was like a chip on his shoulder? Did it ever bother you?
I mean, it didn't bother me. I didn't quite understand it. It's like we'd sit in interviews and people would try to inflame him. I mean, they would literally intentionally try to get a rise out of Dave. So they'd just get him talking about it. And, you know, in my mind, and again, I wasn't in Metallica, so I didn't have that experience. But in my mind, it was like, hey, we've got an amazing band here. And regardless of what you wrote over there with Metallica, I think you're writing better stuff here. And I still feel that
way. Way better.
Even when I go back and I listen to No Life to Leather, which became the Kill 'Em All album, you know, Dave's music was always more progressive. It was more, I think, always dynamic. I love Metallica. I'm a Metallica fan. And so to me, they're two very different bands. It's not, to me, the crossing of that was many years ago. And I when Metallica put something new out, I always listen to it. I buy it. One of my favorite Dave songs is Jump in the Fire, which is actually it's probably one of the simpler songs Dave's ever written. I love the riff. I like to play guitar, and I can play that. It's not too difficult. So I actually like that song. If I just pick up a guitar and play a Metallica song, it's probably that one, because I can play it.
I actually have a follow-up question to that.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Where is that damn thing? Well, you kind of answered that one. As a matter of fact, here's the other part of it. You've been sober for quite some time, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which
30 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's over the top. Congratulations. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, look, you know, that is a discipline too. I mean, that didn't just come to me out of nowhere. I mean, believe me, that was anyone who knows, who may be watching this, who's either just on the other side of that, or maybe have just made that turn or have been in this road, you know, there's disciplines. It's just like going to the gym and eating well. I mean, it doesn't, you know, your health doesn't just happen. You have to, you know, nurture that, you know. So
I think I have one of your documentaries where you're like, it's been 2 months, no pot, no heroin, no alcohol.
Oh, you know, you're right. God is right. We were doing the warm-up.
I remember that. I got that somewhere around here, man.
You know what? You're right. I saw that recently. We were, Nick, when we started the Rust in Peace tour, Nick wanted his friend Juan to come out and film all this behind the scenes stuff. And it was actually a brilliant idea for Nick and he wanted to do this whole, I mean, Metallica kind of did it, a year and a half in the life of Metallica. That was sort of the thinking, you know, before they even did that, we already kind of had all this footage, and, you know, we didn't hire film crews. This was just one, you know, Nick's buddy Juan riding with us on the bus and everywhere we went. And he grabbed some really great moments. Yeah. Like, I remember like coming off stage and back in the dressing room and stuff while we were on tour with Judas Priest and that. And then we turned it into Capitol, and they just completely dismissed it. They just, after a while, whoever it was, just opened the closet and said, just gave it away. And it's now public. Hey, it sucks, because it's really, it's priceless stuff. It's gold, man. It's great stuff.
All that shit, like the Pantera home videos. Mm-hmm. Everybody's
Well, what's funny about when I watch it, I go, God, I was an asshole. I was just so full of piss and vinegar. I mean, again, I just come off heroin. I had come off, you know, coke and booze and pot. And you know what I mean? I mean, I was, you know, I was happy to be clean for sure. But, you know, that turn, you know, you don't just go from, you know, down in the gutter to, you know, living on the hill overnight. Right. I mean, it's a process. Yeah. So I look at it and I'm just like, God, man, I must have been.
It's your hands. No, I'm doing great right now. Hey, I wasn't dealing with Mr. Mustaine and all the other bullshit scenarios that you had to deal with while they or him was dealing with the drugs and the gorilla on his back while you were trying to keep it clean, man. How the hell did you do that?
Well, look, you know, we're brothers in arms, you know, and you know, when people have addiction, and this myself included, I think because I've gone through it, you know, you don't look people at people, you look at them as being sick, you know, because it's an illness. It's not a willpower issue. Look, getting too high at a party and driving your car into the wall, like, yeah, that's stupid. Okay, don't do that, you know. But when you actually have an addiction thing, you know, I think there comes a place where we start to look upon people as being sick. They need help. And I went through that. And so, I mean, look, you could ask Dave the same thing about me. In fact, as I watch some of those videos you're talking about, and Dave will come in the room and kind of shut things down, I look at it and go, yeah, he probably needed to do that. We were getting a little freaking out there. You know what I mean? And I
saw this interview with Mustaine talking about, he was my running buddy, man. I wanted to spike his coffee with crack, man.
I mean, we were total running buddies. And I think the bigger miracle is that we survived all the turns, and look, we love each other like brothers, you know, and you know, we don't always agree on everything. And I remember he said that. He goes, hey, if we agree on everything, one of us is unnecessary. You know? So it was kind of like the agree to disagree. We have different roles in the band. And, you know, over here in Team Ellison, we always say stay in your lane, you know. And I think that was, I had to learn that a little bit. Like, just stay in my lane, you know. Don't be Dave. Let him be him. He does what he does. You know, he sings, he writes songs, he plays guitar. I play bass. I write once in a while. And, you know, be settled in my role, you know. And I think that's what happens in these sort of career bands is, you know, we grow up and we turn into different people. We want new life experiences, get married, have kids, grow families, you know, whatever it is, excuse me. And those are turns, because all of a sudden you're looking at your buddy going, you're not the same guy you were before, you know. And that's why I said in Dave's book, I said, you know, all those years of us getting loaded, if that didn't ruin our friendship, turning the corner into sobriety was a harrowing turn, you know. And those first, I mean, I remember specifically a moment in the at Rumble Recorders in Canoga Park when we were making Rust in Peace, and David just gotten clean. I'd been clean for a few weeks, and we're just trying to figure out, like, where do we meet up, you know? Because the old, hey, I'll hand you a bindle and run off in the bathroom and you do your share and hand it off to me, you know, under the table, and I'll do my share, you know, like the old running buddy, you know, getting high credo was off the table, you know? You know, it was learning how do we do this sober thing for each other, for ourselves, and how do we sort of complement each other with that? And that, quite honestly, that's what the Rust in Peace tour was just learning how to, you know, grow up and start a new friendship.
How's his health, by the way? How's he doing? I know you.
He's good. Yeah, he's doing all right. Yeah. He's turned some heroin corners, and, you know, and he's a tough dude, man. He's a fighter.
Man, dude, like, you guys are amazing. I don't want to keep floating your jammy here, but I mean, seriously, technicality, the whole thing. All right, duly noted.
Yeah.
All right, this comes from my buddy Justin Doucette, used to be in a band with me. Probably the biggest Megadeth fan in the world. Of all bass guitars and amps you have played on and acquired through the years, which and what means the most to you?
You know, they all have a place. You know, little, small, lightweight amps that are very popular right now have a place in a lot of music. Cabarets, jazz clubs, for certain types of music, they're great. They're not right for me. Big amp, I guess. Yeah, I mean, you know, they have a place. The Ampeg SVT, which is always the amp all my heroes used when I was growing up in the 70s. When I finally plugged in one, I was like, wow, this is weird. It doesn't sound good. In fact, I think the first time I actually used one in Megadeth was at Castle Donington in 1988 when we finished our tour over there. And it was an old one. It had a really high gain on the front end, which means it was very distorted, which is not my sound and does not work well in Megadeth. So it was a really troublesome amp for me on the biggest gig we ever played. And it was a backline rental situation. So because it was over in England. So I had a terrible experience with it. And I use Ampeg equipment all the time for various purposes, you know, when I come into different things. And I've learned how to use it and when it's applicable. You know, the go-to amp for me that I did, I just plug in and just always delivers a sound that I like and my sort of my ears and my hands play to is the Harkey stuff. And that's when I started using that back in 1987, kind of tour, I think towards the end of the P-Cells tour, and then rolling. The first album I recorded with it was So Far So Good, So What? And then Rust in Peace and Countdown to Extinction.
Saying this, man. Do you still have that bass you were playing, that Van Halen tune when you met Dave Mustaine?
No. That's a good question. That was a BC Rich Mockingbird. Actually, I got that. I bought that from Ed Roman, who had Ed Roman's guitars in Las Vegas before he passed. But he had a company called East Coast Sound out of Danbury, Connecticut, and I bought it from him. It was a Longhorn BC Rich Koa. I think it was a Koa body with maple stripes on it, and that's what I took out to Hollywood. And then I met Dave, and then he had a BC Rich. He had the Rich Bitch, which was the option of a 6 or 10 string guitar. He played it 6 string, and so, you know, it was like the BC Rich revolution. And then our first drummer, Gar, about a year later, we got him in the band, and he worked at BC Rich. He was the general manager of the place. Kerry King, when he played with us, he was a BC Rich guy.
That's right. Wow, that's good.
Yeah. So BC Rich, I know Nicky, you know, he played the Warlock. They were Lita Ford was playing him, Rick Derringer. I remember going with Gar down to meet Rick Derringer at Cherokee Studios. He was producing a band called Madam X, and who are actually on my record label on EMP. We put a record out for them, and so it's kind of funny how all these people that stay in the game over all these years, you know, we get to share stories of our journey, you know.
That must be awesome, man. Seriously. Mm. we're almost wrapping up with these questions, man. I've got one. This one also comes from me.
Okay.
What's your favorite Megadeth album, and then following it up with what's your favorite song and why?
You know, I don't have favorites, to be honest with you. And that goes with everything. I don't have a favorite pudding. I don't have a favorite coffee. I don't have a favorite car. You know, to me, life is about enjoying all of them, you know. And I have my preferences on different days. You know, I mean, I think pound for pound, the Countdown to Extinction record probably has my favorite collection of songs. And part of that could just be from my own personal experience of how we put it together. I mean, an album I don't listen to a lot and have started to listen to a lot more in recent years is Euthanasia. And I'm floored at how good it is and how good we played. Because I knew the songs were great. I always knew that. We spent a lot of time. We really were working well together as a band, crafting songs. But when I say how good it is, meaning how good we played together, because we cut those tracks with me, Dave, Marty, and Nick as one take, and then we'd move on to the next song. So, I mean, that what you hear there, that's us in the room playing together. And anyone who's made records knows that that's not normally how the process is. And the overdubbing process just takes, you know, Max Norman, I did a podcast with him last year, and he said it best. He goes, music is about a conversation between the musicians, and even a conversation maybe between the musician and the listener. But certainly as you're creating it, it's a conversation. And he talked about that, like when you're in the room together, because he engineered those first two Ozzy records, and we were talking about that, about just how when you're in the room, there's a conversation and you play off of each other, just like we are right now. When one of us is talking, the other listens. If there's an excitement, you jump in. Oh my God. Hey, you know what I mean? Like that's the conversation. It's push and pull. It's that. And when it's just you talked and then I come in and you're recording me talking and then you piece that together, That's a very different sounding interview than did the two of us doing this together. And music's no different, you know what I mean? So to record all these parts separate, as much as you can make it perfect, you know, we don't always want perfect. And I heard a great story. The guy, I think he was from Sun Records. He was tasked by the label. He went to Elvis. They wanted to put out an Elvis live. Either it was a live album or maybe it was a live radio broadcast. And Elvis reportedly said, he got nervous. He goes, look, I don't sing great every night. I make mistakes. I'm flat. I'm sharp, whatever. On and off the mic. You know, there's just stuff, you know. And he said to him, he said, we don't want the perfect recording. We want the perfect imperfect recording.
Right. That's like the Beatles with Twist and Shout, man. John Lennon's voice was haggard by the end of that. You can hear it and it sounds that cool when it comes through like that.
Exactly. And that's when we like that. It's like we want human emotion, you know, and just that. Sometimes we want ragged humanness, you know. That's part of the charm.
Well, dude, I'm gonna say I freaking love you. Thank you, dude. Like, you are the man. I can't thank you enough for this. You're welcome. So look, man, I speak for a lot of people. We love Megadeth. We love you. We love the whole scene. And speaking for myself, I owe you my kidney for this. You are the absolute.
Keep it and hand it off to the next guy. Thank you. You're all good, man. You're all good.
So once again, I want everybody to remember this shit. Rockstar Hitman.
Yep.
The film Dwellers and Ellison Band CD. No cover. Check it out, man.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, man.
Thanks, Margo.
Over here. I love you, buddy. All right. Talk to you later, man.
All right.